be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Jefferson will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Charles Jefferson, and I'm here today on behalf of the petitioners, Russell Leach, Cal Cruz, and Procom Marketing Services. Leach and Cruz were officers and owners of a corporation, Procom Marketing. Procom had originally been in the business of selling cable TV contracts, but had branched out into installation. Since neither Leach nor Cruz had any experience with installing cable, they hired an individual, Grady Hornsby, to be the technical manager of the company. Mr. Hornsby hired the cable installers, he trained them, he supervised them, he was responsible for the quality of their work, and he was also the person who coordinated jobs actually installing the cable. In September 1990, while lifting a reel of cable out of the back of his truck, Mr. Hornsby severely injured his back. Neither Leach nor Cruz was on the job site at the time or at any time. In fact, they were at the corporate offices in Dallas. At trial, Hornsby's sole complaint against Leach and Cruz, and for that matter the corporation, was that he had requested that he be furnished with a lift belt and a dolly, and that Leach and Cruz had taken no action. So the question presented by our point of error number one is, can individual corporate officers be found liable for negligence simply for taking no action? And under Texas law, most recently in the Portlock v. Perry case cited in our application, the first answer is clear enough. You cannot be liable for inaction unless you have an affirmative duty to act. Now, it's undisputed in Texas that every corporation has a non-delegable duty to all of its employees to provide those workers with safe tools and a safe workplace. But what is novel about Judge Hardberger's opinion is that he extends that non-delegable duty from the corporation itself to its individual officers. And what's particularly interesting about the opinion is that he does so with such a complete absence of discussion as to why this is an appropriate thing to do. In the first paragraph, right-hand column of page 250, he refers to the corporation's non-delegable duty. In the second paragraph, he goes on to refer to an officer's non-delegable duties to the company's employees without citing any authority that there is such a duty or explaining why it would be desirable that such a duty exists. Ordinarily, if one were going to create a new common law duty, one would expect an analysis of the existing Texas common law showing how Texas has gradually broadened liabilities and this new extension would be appropriate. One would expect to see an analysis of the case law of other common law jurisdictions to show that they have adopted such a rule and how it has worked out in those other jurisdictions. And although courts are not the legislature, if a new common law duty is to be created, one would expect some policy analysis to show that the new duty will actually improve worker safety and not cause other social harm. Well, Judge Hardberger didn't do that, but we've tried to do it in the application. And as far as Texas common law is concerned, Texas courts have consistently refused to create a duty for individual officers and supervisors so that their failure to act to prevent injury to workers constitutes negligence. We referred to three cases in our brief, Loud v. Sears Roebuck, in which a superintendent failed to show up to provide assistance he had promised to a worker. A summary judgment in favor of Sears Roebuck was reversed, but the summary judgment that the corporate superintendent had no liability was sustained. In the Jane Weingarten case v. Moore, which is closer to our own fact situation, the corporation there was held liable because a corporate officer had failed to provide safety instructions on how properly to lift an object. But the officer himself was not found liable because he had no individual duty to the worker. Finally, in the Portlock v. Perry case, suit was brought against the owner of the business, and the court held that simply because the man was an owner and officer, he had no duty to institute quality controls. So Texas has not edged up to the brink of this new duty. In fact, Texas case law has pretty uniformly rejected it. As far as other states are concerned, no state is strictly comparable with Texas, because Texas is the only non-subscriber state that I'm aware of where companies are able to opt out of the workers' compensation program. But while in Texas, if a company has workers' comp insurance, all of its employees are exempt from suit. In a number of other American jurisdictions with workers' comp, only the company is exempt, and the injured worker is free to sue his fellow employees, including corporate officers, for negligence. And that is the topic that was covered in the supplemental brief we submitted last week. There appears to be a general American common law rule that simply because the corporate officer has general supervisory responsibility, and therefore the authority to adopt safety rules if he chooses to do so, that this does not create an individual duty which renders him liable to injured workers when he takes no action. A couple of the states, most notably Florida and Wisconsin, have gone even farther and created a standard which says the corporate officer is not liable unless his actions have actually increased the risk of harm to the worker. When you look at the cases in the supplemental brief, the one case, the Haswell case out of South Dakota, where the corporate officer was found liable, was a case where the corporate president was actually operating the crane on the job site whose boom collapsed and crushed the injured worker beneath him. That was direct negligence on his part. But what these cases say is that unless you are directly involved in the work, or unless the corporation has appointed you to be the person in charge of safety and has created a duty for you for the benefit of the other workers in the corporation, simply because you're an executive, simply because you have authority, is not a sufficient basis to impose negligence liability for taking no action. As to the third point, what kind of public policy implications does Judge Hardberger's new rule have?
Before you move to that point, do you place much weight or importance on the fact that the jury failed to find that two individuals were the alter ego of the corporation?
Well, I do, Your Honor. One of the issues that was litigated extensively in the trial court was the plaintiff's attempt. They planted and jury issues were submitted, attempt to show that Leach and Cruz, in fact, were the corporation. The corporation was a mere alter ego and didn't have any real independent existence of its own. And if the jury had found that, obviously we wouldn't be here arguing this point. But the jury rejected that point, that the corporation was separate and distinct from the individuals. So you can't just go through and pierce the corporate veil in order for the plaintiff to prevail here. There has to have been a showing sufficient in the lower courts that the individual officers were themselves negligent. As far as public policy is concerned, Judge Hardberger's rule, sort of by the back door, as it were, pretty well abolishes the non-subscriber system in Texas. That is, corporate officers who now find themselves facing unlimited liability for the safety of all employees of a corporation pretty well have to insist that their corporation get the insurance to protect them. And I think that's why we received an amicus brief from the Texas Association of Responsible Non-Subscribers. That may be a reasonable policy position, but the legislature has created our current non-subscriber system, and it shouldn't be abolished by stealth, as it were. The second point, though, I think is more serious, and that is that the rule that Judge Hardberger has created is really an impossible rule. That is, that if you have a corporation of any size at all, there is no way that, say, 40 or 50 corporate officers can have each and every one of them individual responsibility to look after a couple of thousand workers. It cannot be done, even if they spent 12 hours a day doing nothing but trying to keep track of all 1,000 or 2,000 workers of the company. And in fact, a rule which says that everybody is responsible for all practical purposes is a situation where nobody is responsible. That is, if you take one person and you say, Mr. Jefferson, you are responsible for the safety of the workers at the San Antonio job site. Well, I've been given a task and I can do it. But if all 50 corporate officers are told that you're responsible for the safety of workers at every place in Texas or the nation where we have workers, it cannot be done, and because it cannot be done, nothing will be done. So this is a rule which is very unlikely actually to make workers safer, which is the only reason for adopting it in the first place. We have two other points of error, both of which we think deserve some serious attention, although they're perhaps not as important to the overall law of the state. The evidence was presented at trial to show that there was an industry-wide custom in the cable installation business. The plaintiff, Grady Hornsby, testified that he had been employed by 8 to 10 different cable installation companies, and that not one of them had ever provided him with a lift belt.
And despite the fact that he repeatedly requested a lift belt?
Well, I believe he testified he repeatedly requested it from this company.
Right.
But if he requested it anywhere else, he didn't get it from anywhere else.
From this company, though, he did repeatedly request it and never did receive it.
He never received it.
And I'm sure that you are aware that the company is obligated to provide a safe place to work for all its employees.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
And I'm sure you're aware to the point that it's virtually common knowledge that people are highly likely to injure their backs when lifting heavy objects.
I'm aware of that too, Your Honor.
And I saw no evidence in the record whatsoever that the company did anything in any way to try to prevent this particular individual from suffering a back injury when it came to him lifting heavy objects.
Your Honor, they may have taken no action, but our fourth point of error also granted is that there is no evidence of any sort in this record that a lift belt has done the least amount of good.
How about George Dominguez's testimony that there was an alternative method of unloading a cable that would not have required a worker to lift cable reels?
Okay, that testimony is in the record, but that alternate method presumably could have been used by the plaintiff. His testimony was that he'd been lifting cable for many years. He knew how to lift cable. And he would not have lifted cable the way he did if he hadn't thought it was safe at the time he lifted it.
Did the company ever provide any instruction on how to lift cable?
If it did, it did it through Mr. Hornsby, because Mr. Hornsby was the person at the company who was responsible for training and supervising cable installation.
Let me rephrase it. Is there any evidence in the record indicating that the company informed or educated the plaintiff how to lift cable?
No, Your Honor.
But who would have done that if the company was going to do it?
Mr. Hornsby would have done it. The people had initially been running a cable sales business. They branched out of installation. When they branched out into an area they weren't personally familiar with, they hired someone who was.
Do you think it would be permissible or satisfactory under Texas law if I decided to tomorrow go by this company and be ignorant of what the people working on the job need to do with regard to lifting, and that I could escape liability simply because of my ignorance?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I think that you'd have a duty to hire someone. If you didn't know yourself, either learn yourself, or better yet, hire an expert who already knows, which is more or less what happened here. As far as our...
There's no liability to you then if you disregard that expert's request. Request for belts and bowels?
Well, we'd say two things, Your Honor. We'd say, first of all, based on this record, there's really no evidence that either one would have helped prevent this accident. And I refer specifically to the testimony in the record. All that there is testimony from Larry Whidden, the fellow worker whom Judge Hardberger relied on, but that testimony was objected to and the objection was sustained. So clearly it was improper to rely on that. And then the testimony from Dr. Gable, who may be one of the last nonpartisan doctor witnesses in the state of Texas, is when he was asked about whether a lift belt would help, and this is the only testimony in the record about lift belts, he said, I don't think there are any studies proving the amount of belts or use of them or width or anything that would predict any decrease in the amount of injuries.
So you don't have a direct answer to the duty question, so causation.
The corporation has a duty to its workers, but there is no evidence that the corporation breached its duty by failing to provide lift belts.
Even if, as you say, they didn't know anything about the business, so they hired an expert
who made a request which they did not comply with.
That's correct. It would still be up to this expert to prove at trial that if he had had a lift belt.
So that's causation.
It would have prevented the injury.
No need for big argument. Your defense on that point is causation.
That's correct. That there is no proximate cause. There's no causation in fact.
Any other questions?
Were you trial counsel, Mr. Jefferson?
No, I was not, Your Honor.
Well, apparently trial counsel was made similar arguments to the jury. The jury didn't buy it. The jury found there was negligence, breach of duty, and pretty healthy damages.
Well, Your Honor,
and we have to look at whether or not there's some evidence to support the jury verdict.
Well, that's correct. Mr. Hornsby was a severely injured individual. His life has been severely affected. He's entitled to a lot of sympathy. But if providing a lift belt would not have prevented this injury, then there should not be a recovery. Well,
why is a lift belt the only possible way in which there would be causation? What about failure to properly instruct an employee?
There were all sorts of matters raised in the plaintiff's pleadings. There was a litany of 6 or 8 potential acts of negligence, but at trial, I believe, and they can find some more if they're there, but the only evidence that came in involved the lift belt and the dolly and nothing else.
Did the jury instruction say, do you find that the defendants were liable for failing to provide a lift belt?
No, I believe that the instruction is, do you find the defendants are negligent? It's a broader issue. But the only evidence that was presented at trial involved these 2 specific alleged acts, not the 6 or other 8 others that have been pled.
Other questions? The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Nicholson will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, let me respond to Justice Adams. There was testimony that none of the employees had instructions. There was testimony about safety meetings, what was said at safety meetings, what was not said at safety meetings. It was kind of odd at trial because at trial it was the position of PROCON there were not the employers of Mr. Hornsby or any of the of his co-employees, and that another corporation called CTS was the employer. So there was testimony both as to CTS and as to PROCON as to whether there were safety meetings, whether there were instructions on that.
Who employed Mr. Hornsby?
Judge, that was an issue at trial, of course, that was submitted to the jury. Mr. Hornsby was initially hired as an independent contractor by the PROCON principals in PROCON marketing. Thereafter, they had a tax problem as to whether they could really legitimately treat these employees, or treat these people working for them, there were 60 or 70 of them, as employees or as independent contractors, or whether they were employees. So they went to another person in the corporation who was kind of at the level of Mr. Hornsby and had him set up another corporation called CTES. And over a period of about 3 months, according to the defendants, all of the employees of PROCON Marketing were put into CTES, Cable Television Employment Services, and then released back to PROCON. Now, that was disputed at trial. Mr. Hornsby said, I was always the employer of PROCON. Mr. Dominguez said, I was always the employer of PROCON. Mr. Whitten, another employee, said, I was always the employer of PROCON.
They never said, I was employed by Mr. Legion Cruz?
They never said specifically I was employed by Mr. Leach and Mr. Cruz.
Well, how can they be held liable if they were not the employers?
Well, they're held liable under existing Texas law, Justice Gonzalez, under the Portlock case, which Justice Hardberger did discuss in the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals. He said, unlike Portlock, where we had an oil field engineer who simply invested in a medical services corporation and knew nothing about what was going on, nothing about the anesthesia the little 4.5-year-old girl got that caused her injuries and subsequent death. This is a situation where Leach and Hornsby participated in the actual tort. This is not a situation like there where we had someone who's totally divorced from the business operation.
Yeah, but how does that argument fly, have any validity, particularly when the jury failed to find that they were the alter ego of the corporation?
Well, Judge, if you think about the alter ego issue, was did they act in corporate form? Did they commingle the corporate assets? Did they file their franchise fee? And there was testimony that they did all these things. They have a Texas corporation. They have an articles of incorporation. They have a charter. It's filed for franchisees. CTS had problems with that. But so if you look at what the jury was looking at, did they operate as a corporation? The question was yes. But unlike the way the petitioner would like to frame this issue, it's not that these two individuals have liability coextensive with the corporation. They're not liable merely because the corporation's liable and their shareholders. They're liable because they actively participated in the tort.
What is the basis of the duty owed by a non-employer to these employees?
The basis
to these workers, to the particular horse.
Okay. In this situation,
is that an employer? Where does that duty stem from?
It stands from a reasonable person faced with a situation where there's foreseeable harm and the conduct that they must conform to that flows therefrom.
But what is the relationship? You know, if it's not an employer-employee relationship, what is the relationship that gives rise to duty?
Their duty is to effectuate the corporate purpose. Corporate purpose is to provide safe work environment, safe tools. The reason the employees in this case were not given that is because leaks and forms didn't effectuate the corporate purpose. Now, they would like to characterize their numerous conversations with employees where they said, we will not give you safety devices, as corporate decisions you can give. But there's no evidence there was ever a board meeting. There's no evidence this was a decision of the corporation. There's no evidence other than two individuals, granted shareholders, officers, president, vice president, also managers, supervisors. This is not like the president of General Motors who's sitting in a boardroom forming some general corporate policy. These are people on the day-to-day operations effectuating corporate policy. They said no. Now, the existing Texas case law discussed by Justice Hardberger, cited in their brief, and in matter of fact, the rule that the other courts decide the case is cited in the petitioner's brief, is that officers and other employees and agents of a corporation are liable if they participate in the tort or have actual knowledge of the tortious conduct.
So failure to act as a tort.
Well, not failure to act. It's affirmatively saying, no, we will not give you the safety devices. Unlike the Portlock case, where we had an oil field investor in a corporation who simply did nothing except invest, these are people who participated in not giving the safety device.
What about the argument that there's no testimony that the safety belts have done anything to prevent the injury?
Well, that's untrue. What we do, Dr. Geibel did not say that, Justice Geibel. What he said was possible. But what we do have is the testimony of Mr. Witt, who said the safety belt would have eliminated this injury.
Is he qualified? Isn't that an opinion?
I don't know whether it is or not, Judge. It was objected to, but there was no instruction to the jury to disregard the testimony. And, of course, under Texas law, that then is testimony that the jury can consider.
Even though it was objected to and sustained.
Judge, if the case law is objected to, sustained, and a request for a curative instruction or a motion for mistrial, that's how you preserve an objection to objectionable testimony. So that is testimony in the record. That is testimony that was not properly preserved. It's not testimony that could just be slightly brushed off as if it didn't exist. The testimony is in the record by Mr. Whitten, and it's not properly preserved if they had an objection to it, Your Honor. So that testimony in and of itself is sufficient testimony to find the proximate cause. I might also say, Judge, when they get to this issue about their issues 3 and 4, they never address the dolly at all. They never address whether the dolly would have not prevented this accident.
Do you have evidence? Is there expert evidence in the record that it would have?
No, there's testimony by Mr. Gonzalez that the dolly would have assisted in the lifting of this.
How would it?
Well, the dolly, Judge, you would not have had to lift the cable up and put it on the tech and then lift it down to the ground. You simply slide the dolly under it.
You slide it under it in the truck. That was the argument.
Well,
the argument's up here and the dolly's down here, and once you get it down there...
No, once you have the dolly in the truck and you can edge it over the side of the truck. I mean, to say that without a dolly, with a dolly is the same hazard as without a dolly, simply is not common knowledge, Judge. I mean, you could put the dolly over the edge and lever the cable down to the ground. You could have brought a board, supposedly, and lowered it down to the ground. So to say that, for them to raise a no evidence point strictly as to the lift belt and not to address the no evidence point on the dolly or on the other allegations of negligence, Judge, simply doesn't give them grounds for reversal of the Court of Appeals opinion.
Is he right that there is no other evidence?
No, he's incorrect, Judge. There is testimony replete by Mr. Dominguez, Mr. Whitting, Mr. Hornsby about safety meetings was held and the fact that they were never given instructions.
Or how was the case?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Instructions?
Right, on any safety procedures on the job site. Now, there are
any expert testimony that said that was necessary?
No, Judge. There was no expert testimony that said that would be necessary to do that.
Well, indeed, Hornsby, whoever he was employed by.
Yeah. Well, the jury found croaked on the judge.
Was he hired, is evidence in the record, such that he was hired to be in charge of this aspect of the business?
Yeah, there is some evidence in the record, Judge. There's evidence by the defendants, Mr. Leach and Mr. Cruz. That evidence he denies specifically in the record, Judge, that he was hired as the safety manager. He admits I'm basically in charge of the installation. I'm kind of on the job type of person. He initially testified that he did not necessarily know more than Leach or Cruz about the installation of cable. He was, in fact, impeached with his deposition where he said, you know, I do know more than Leach and Cruz about the actual installation of the cable. So his position was technical manager. His employment was an issue. The employer was an issue. His position really was not an issue, his technical manager installing the cable. He did dispute that he was not the safety, did not have safety duties in that.
Mr. Nicholson, do I understand that the basis of your claim against Leach and Cruz is that they affirmatively said no to the request for the safety equipment?
Well, Judge, I don't want to get locked into saying we're only here on safety equipment. In fact, we allege failure to instruct, we allege failure to have safety meetings, and so failure to have a dolly, and so there are
whatever you claim
right.
They should have done.
Right.
Predicate for your claim of liability against them is because they said the word no.
Yeah, they affirmatively did not effectuate the state policy of providing a service or safe working place for workers. The corporation has a non-delegable duty, but don't take that.
You're confusing me with affirmatively. They affirmatively did nothing.
Well, they affirmatively said the word no.
What they said is no.
Yeah, they affirmatively said that.
Is it? I mean, so is that critical to your position? If they said no, or could a corporate officer get a letter of request for something and toss in the trash and do nothing? Is that your view of taking an affirmative step to say no?
I wouldn't want to stretch it to that, Judge. I'm not really sure. If like in potluck, where a corporate officer simply is ignorant about the policies of the corporation and really has no daily active participation in the management of the corporation, that's clearly that's clearly.
If they don't honor the request, that's affirmative negligent conduct.
Absolutely, Judge. They were ignorant about the situation, that they were ignorant about the hazard. Jury found it was foreseeable. Jury found it was proximate cause. Jury found that they were negligent.
I'm assuming they were aware of the request.
Right.
Your point is whether they. Earlier you said the affirmative act here was the saying of no.
Absolutely.
And I just want to clarify,
yeah.
That's really not your point.
No, Judge, it is my point, but I don't want to strictly say we're here strictly on seatbelts. There are other allegations of negligence in the record that are unchallenged in this court. There are allegations of no safety meetings. There are allegations of failure to instruct. There's not a no evidence point on the dollar.
I'm just talking about your allegations
right.
against two individuals,
on the first issue.
And Cruz.
Right.
Conceded the company didn't sponsor a safety deal.
Right.
But you say Leach and Cruz are individually liable.
Absolutely, Jim.
Because they said
no
to the request.
Right. They said, no, we'll not give you the safety belt. And that's not passive conduct. Where it becomes critical, Judge, is where there's a non-delegable duty by a judge, such as a corporation, to provide a safe working place, it doesn't matter whether they're nonfeasance or misfeasance. They simply have a duty and it wasn't performed. But where there is no duty, that's where duty is crucial, you cannot be found liable for nonfeasance. I hope you follow me. You can only be found liable for misfeasance. So if there's a non-delegable duty, as the Pollock case says, if nonfeasance simply means the omission to do something where there's an affirmative duty to act, And if you have an affirmative duty to act and you don't do anything, you're liable. Nonfeasance or misfeasance, doesn't matter. But where you have no affirmative duty to act, you cannot be liable for nonfeasance.
Is the record correct that this cable weighed 65 pounds?
Well, the testimony goes 45 to 65. There's a testimony of 65, and someone said even as much as 100 pounds.
How much did the cable... Does he actually lift it?
Yeah, Mr. Hornsby, I believe, said 65. Mr. Whittington said 45 to 65 is my recollection. And I believe also Mr. Cruz testifies to the weight, but I don't know specifically what he said the weight was. But it's everybody kind of agrees in that range, 45 to 65, and several witnesses mentioned 65. So briefly, let me touch upon the other two issues. On the custom issue, I believe that the prerequisites to find a custom that other industries or other businesses in the industry did not provide safety belts. The predicate for that, I'm quoting the restatement of torts, is that it needs to be shown that the actor's locality, and it must be known that the actor was charged with knowledge of this industry custom. And here we have Mr. Hornsby saying, I've worked for 6 or 8 other people, or 8 or 10 other people. Some of them provided safety belts, which are different than lifting belts. The safety belt here is narrower and has tools on. This testimony that would have assisted in preventing this accident by Mr. Hornsby. He said no one provided lifting belts per se at that time. No knowledge no evidence as to where those companies were, how large those companies were, how long he worked, what capacity he was actually working for when he was in those companies, because he testifies that he did sales and participated in other activities in the cable TV industry. So there is no predicate to find an industry custom in this case, Judge. There's simply evidence of what Mr. Hornsby did, not evidence of what an industry did, not that it's pervasive, not that it was known by Procom, known by CGS, known by Leach.
Did Mr. Hornsby testify in the capacity of an expert in addition to a non-expert?
There was never any objection to any of his testimony on the basis that, as I recall, Judge, that he was not an expert to testify about this. My recollection, I was not trial counsel, and I will stand to be corrected by the record. My recollection is he was not designated as an expert. But
he did provide opinion testimony,
right, Judge,
concerning the use of safety belts.
Yes, yes. And finally, Judge, point number four, I think by virtue of the fact that Mr. Whitting testified that the safety belt, the lift belt in this case, would have eliminated this injury, there was no request for the jury to disregard that testimony. I think that in and of itself is sufficient on a no evidence point. You need to recall this is a no evidence point because no evidence that a safety belt would have prevented this for purposes of proximate cause is sufficient to at least overcome a no evidence point.
Mr. Nicholson, I understand that you pled failure to provide a safe place to work as well as some additional more specific allegations.
Justice Cornyn.
Were there ever any special exceptions lodged to the plaintiff's pleadings?
There are none in this transcript, Judge. This was the fifth amended. We went to trial on the fifth amended petition. At least for purposes of this court's record, there's no evidence of any special exceptions to it. In conclusion, the opinion of the Court of Appeals is not an aberration of law. This is not a case where the court simply said, we're going to make the duties of officers of a corporation coextensive with that of the corporation itself. This is a case where the Court of Appeals specifically found that these two individuals actively participated in the tort.
When we have a specific jury finding that Mr. Hornsby was employed by Procom.
Yes, sir.
So how does the Court of Appeals make the jump that even though Hornsby works for Procom, the officers of the corporation who don't employ Mr. Hornsby are going to be stuck with liability?
Well,
and the law is going to impose a duty.
Again, Justice Gonzalez, in the Potluck case, talks about circumstances where agents can be liable in furtherance of corporate purposes, in furtherance of purposes of their own. And they can be liable when they engage in misfeasance, when they actively participate. So If the jury had found that they were alter egos, that's all we would need to do. Their liability would be coextensive with the corporation for all purposes. In this case, the jury didn't find that. The jury simply found you also, Mr. Cruz, you also, Mr. Leach, participated in a tort, and we're finding liability because of your own conduct, not by virtue of the fact that you're owner of the corporation.
But before you participate in the tort, there has to be a duty recognized by law.
Right.
And we're imposing, if we were to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, liability on corporate officers for acts that the officers did, correct?
That's right. Well, what acts that these people did, when we start talking about whether they're shareholders, whether they're officers, whether they're simply someone hired in this capacity to make sure that the corporate purposes were effectuated, we're talking about them acting in that capacity. Now, I know petitioner would like to kind of convert this case into simply saying they're liable because of shareholders. The court said they're liable because they're officers. That's not what the court said. The court said they're liable by their conduct. So I know that point is made so many times in the petitioner's brief that it's sometimes hard to forget what we're really looking at here. We're not looking at the Court of Appeals opinion who says they're liable simply because they're corporate officers. Justice Hardberger specifically said they're liable because they participated, and that's why they're liable in this case, and they were not liable in the Potluck case, where we had an engineer who simply didn't participate in the decision.
How can a corporation ever participate without the individuals who work for the corporation participating? That's how a corporation does that.
And that's why the case law, Justice Abbott, says that when an employee participates in the tort as an agent, when an agent participates in a tort, he is liable.
But a corporation can never commit a tort without having some employee or agent of the corporation participating in the tort.
That's right. But they're all there.
Under your theory, then, every tort that's committed by a corporation would necessarily involve individual liability on the part of the individual at the corporation who was involved in the tort.
I don't know if that's necessarily the case. Case, Justice Abbott. I mean, clearly we're not talking about liability for people in the corporation who are non-participatory. I mean, so if there was a shareholders meeting in General Motors and they said, we're going to do this corporate policy, and down at some day-to-day level, we're not talking about the people in General Motors. We're talking about the people daily there who effectuate the corporate policy, which in Texas is to give safe devices. There's no evidence that the corporation itself ever made the determination that they were not going to give safe devices in this case. Only evidence is Leach and Cruz didn't do it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Mr. Jefferson, given the employer's duty to provide a safe place to work, is it your contention that it's the plaintiff's burden to specifically plead how that may be provided and to prove that if it had been provided, that this injury would have been avoided?
Pretty much, Your Honor. They don't have to plead and prove what a safe workplace would have looked like, but they have to fix on something and say this something is unsafe.
What if under the circumstances the work is so hazardous that there is no way, given the normal routines of the business, that it could be made safe?
Well, there are
by providing lifting belts or otherwise.
There are special rules, I believe, in Texas for ultra-hazardous occupations, which render
people liable
even for independent contractors.
Right. We're not talking about making dynamite or anything like that. We're talking about just assuming that there's no way that you can prevent a serious back injury under normal circumstances, regardless of the safety measures. Or do you say that the plaintiff can't make a case under those circumstances?
Well, what we're saying, Your Honor, and it was not our burden, but their burden at trial, is that they focus on a few things. Primarily the lift belt, to a lesser extent the dolly, but they didn't put on any expert testimony at all about the dolly. As far as the lift belt is concerned, their only witness was Dr. Geibel, whose testimony I commend you to read very carefully. I only got about a third of the way through it, but he's given about three separate opportunities, and this is even by their lawyer, it's by our lawyer on cross-examination, to testify that a lift belt would have helped or would have prevented the accident or would have decreased the possibility of the accident. He says, beats me. Maybe it would have helped. Maybe it wouldn't. I don't know.
How about Mr. Nicholson's argument regarding the dolly?
Your Honor, again, I don't think that there's any evidence from anybody who's entitled to an opinion that a dolly would have prevented the accident.
Does it take expert testimony to say that a 65-pound reel of cable could be lowered more safely by use of a dolly? Does that require an expert opinion?
Well, phrased like that, it sounds like the answer should be no. But, Your Honor, there are certain types of accidents where all you need is your layman's judgment. The example I give in my brief, I think, was a defective scaffold that drops a load of bricks on someone's head. It's just common sense. It's not good to have a load of bricks dropped on you.
Didn't your clients hire Mr. Hornsby as the expert in this area for the company?
Yes, we did. He was the technical manager, and
did he not provide opinion testimony at trial about the need for safety belts and a dolly?
He testified that he had requested them and that he had been turned down.
And he provided opinion testimony in that regard that those would have been beneficial, did he not?
I can't pinpoint anything specific, but that's a logical inference from his request.
And at trial, there was no objection to his opinion testimony, was there?
No, there wasn't. Okay, with regard to the active participation by my clients, I'm sort of reminded of the Hound of the Baskervilles, where Holmes spoke about the extraordinary incident of the dog in the night, and Watson said, but the dog did nothing. And Holmes said, exactly, that was the extraordinary incident. I mean, they can talk about an affirmative decision to say no, whatever that means. But all that happened is that our clients didn't do anything. And they can call that affirmative, they can call it participation. But what we have is a line of cases, both in Texas and from around the country, that say simply because you're the person in charge, simply because in the Muscarell case in New Jersey, the man was the corporate president and the dominant officer, but they said it's not enough unless the company assigns the duty to you. And this company did not assign the duty to Leach and Cruz. If anyone had it, it was Mr. Hornsby, and a new common law duty should not be created out of thin air in this case.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the second call of the court will take another brief recess.
All right.